Hello and welcome back to This Week on Channel 9. I'm Dan Fernandez.
And I'm Duncan McKenzie.
And Duncan is filling in for Brian Keller, who's, I think, being deported or really busy.
We will go with deported.
Yeah, we'll go with deported. Why not?
Is he not American already?
I think we all know the answer to that one.
Okay.
Which brings us to our first story, kind of a big one. And that is that, mark your calendar, February 29th, Barcelona Mobile World Congress. Leap Day, I hope that's how it's called. They're doing the Windows 8 consumer preview.
Yes, which is not a beta.
Which is not a beta.
No, it's a consumer preview.
It's a consumer preview.
Completely different.
So, what this means... hopefully there'll be a lot more stuff to talk about for that Windows 8 consumer preview. I'm sure watch everyone's favorite blogs, like the B8 blog.
Yes.
Blogs.mcn B8, yep. And I'm sure there'll be much more for us developers, because that's really all we're interested in.
It's what we care about.
We love the consumer stuff. We follow the store.
If I get a consumer preview build on something, then I might actually start showing it. You know, you show it to the family and people, because right now it's sort of like, I don't want to show the build preview because it's for developers. What? And they might go, oh, it's for developers. I don't want to use that.
So I think I'm pretty excited just a couple of weeks ago for this one.
Yes.
So cool stuff coming. Our next story, actually, you'll see a theme here for today's, for this week's episode, and I think it's C++. And really, this is about accelerated massive parallelism. And we've talked about accelerated massive parallelism, or as it's better known, AMP, before on Channel 9. Charles has done a number of videos, but the big thing
Are we allowed to talk about C++ without Charles here?
I think I hope so. I have my past. I hope you have yours.
I don't.
This is
No, I talked to him today. I didn't mention this.
That's going to be a mistake.
You talk about it then.
So, yes. So, AMP, the idea is everybody has these powerful GPUs, or a number of people have GPUs, right? With our normal applications, we're always using things on the processor, but the GPU allows us that much more power. Can we have a general way to do tasks, because GPUs are designed for parallelism, that we can just throw on and make that GPU programmable?
Now, people were already doing this, right? But was it custom per GPU vendor?
There was just so many different things.
Like, I'd have to get NVIDIA libraries, or was there...
Everything.
Okay. And so this gets to where I just write the code, and, hey, there's a GPU, and it uses it?
Yeah, so, and the big announcement here is, of course, it is an open specification, so the idea is people can reuse the specification. And another key thing, and kudos to Greg, if you can see it in the corner, I'll just switch to the picture, is Daniel Moth's blog from a little bit ago, January 30th, where he talks about the examples that he had for VS11 projects using C++ AMP. And some of them even include, C#, Windows, and C# Windows Metro-style applications.
So I'm calling into like a C++ AMP library that I built in C++, or I'm actually calling into C++ AMP the wrappers directly from C#.
You build the library and then you're calling in, so...
That's awesome.
You know, maybe recursion library or something like that. Or give me a list and I'll give you...
Just
you
a,
know,
like a bubble sorted. A bubble sort or something.
Yes, a bubble sort parallelized.
Yeah, awesome.
So lots of cool stuff there, and check out Soma's blog. So our next one, speaking of...
Kind of related.
Yeah.
Now you sit down and you say, well, I'd like to build my C++ AMP library to do my bubble sort, but I don't know how, because I'm a C# developer.
You're one of those new kids. Yeah, we were talking about this before. Everybody's learned either from C or C++ and then moved over to C#.
So looking at this particular item, the idea of going from C# to C++ seems so odd to me because, well, C++ has been around a lot longer, and normally you'd think you'd start with it first, but some people didn't learn to code when I did.
Yes.
So not even you.
No.
Actually, but... Anyway, so then, and they do a throw out to call out to going native, which is nice.
Yes. Now, what is this exactly?
It's a guide. It's like it goes through all the differences. You've seen this before. There's been things like Java to C# guides, VB to C# guides, and I think there's been some.
Yeah, but they always end to C#, which is how I like
so
the world.
Yes. So going that direction, but it's the same idea. So. how do I do a loop? And they explain, okay. And how do I, what are the different constructs? And what's a pointer?
You know, it's really interesting, though. I do want to see this, if, whether they covered C++ 11, because there's so many things in the syntax where, in fact, we'll talk about it in one of our stories in Bjarne's, where they did before and after in terms of cleanliness of code that is just totally different with that new syntax.
And I don't know if it does or not.
Which brings us to Scott Hanselman.
Yes.
What's this about?
Well, so web forms, in a lot of cases, especially if you're following kind of the influential folks, we always talk about MVC, we talk about Razor, we talk about all these things, and poor old web forms seems to be being forgotten. But what this post is about is the fact that they haven't forgotten it. They're still making it better all the time. He points out a lot of the new features that we use when we're doing like MVC apps, like routing and model binding and things like that, are either already there in web forms, routing, or coming to web forms with his model binding. So there's a lot of things you can do. And honestly, we were discussing this already. We sometimes talk before the show.
Sometimes.
About the fact that when you just want to make a quick app, or especially if you're doing a line of business apps, so data grids and things like that, web forms is really fast.
So fast. So
and Hanselman's particular example, he actually goes through and makes a quick CRUD, a grid with all the CRUD support, and it's almost no code and takes a few minutes. And to do the same thing in MVC, although the results would be much more hardcore, would take you a long time.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't forget about web forms.
Right tool for the right job.
I kind of feel the same way about Windows Forms, but I know.
Windows Forms is I don't remember seeing the last time I saw a Windows Forms demo from a Microsoft person.
I could demo it to you.
Okay. Well, I think someone's attached to Windows Forms. Brings us to in the wholly different direction, which is HTML5. And this is 10 myths holding HTML5 back. So some of these myths are kind of classic ones, right? Mm-hmm. So HTML5 is a flash killer.
Yeah, and I think the point of a lot of these is not so much arguing with anybody about what HTML5 can do or not do, but I think it's not 100% one thing. So his example for Flash, this doesn't mean every single Flash app in the world goes away. It doesn't mean every Silverlight app in the world goes away. It means that there's a sort of increased spectrum of things you can do in just HTML5 and JavaScript, mm-hmm. or in HTML and JavaScript. And so HTML5 is just bringing us closer, but we still want, you know, sometimes we need to, I don't know, control a webcam or something like that. And there's things that you just can't do at the moment in, you know, HTML. And so these myths.
I think the other things, too, is just to call out some of the myths are, you know, IE doesn't support HTML5, so we shouldn't, bet
right.
the arm.
Or that the support isn't broad. And honestly, that's been my feeling for a while, but if you look at it, and he gives some specific examples, there's even some aspects that were supported as far back as IE8. And obviously, you know, different fidelity of features, but mm-hmm. you can bring in parts of HTML5. And support across almost every browser, and then, you know, what do they, light up, progressive enhancement. You can basically, so you shouldn't be blocked by the idea that, well, it's not on 100% of browsers, so I can't use it.
Yeah, so if you're an HTML5 developer, and, you know, perhaps you're having to deal with some of these myths, and some of the facts, if you will,
yep.
like, you know, good, the specification,
good
ramification.
Ammunition for talking to your boss.
Right. I think that's a good way to say it. Okay. So that brings us actually to the beta of Amazon Web Services SDK for Windows Phone. So the real key here is if you are a Windows Phone developer and you're using Amazon Web Services, and that service is like S3, Simple DB, and SQS Cloud Services, this goal of the interoperability project is to make it easy to use those services.
Yep. And so if you do want to, I know you're saving your leaderboard scores into SimpleDB or settings, or you're pushing images into S3, its toolkit makes it easier to do. Similar in a lot of ways to the kind of the reverse, like the Windows Azure toolkits for iOS devices and Android and stuff like that. It's that there's these cloud services, these mobile devices,
you
get
just
them to
make
talk
it easier.
Together. Be friends.
Yeah, so it is a beta too. So and they do have a number of samples that come.
You sure
with
it's
SDK.
Not a consumer preview?
It is not a consumer preview. It is not. I hope an SDK does not have a consumer preview. But give them feedback too in terms of what features and, you know, for people that are building on AWS and want to expose stuff for Windows Service, Windows Phone. Now, extension me serialized with encryption. Yeah. So what is this exactly?
Well, it's kind of a crazy title, but it's a lot about basically just data security. So when data is flowing across the wire, so data in motion,
mm-hmm.
you know, you got we'll SSL and you can keep it all encrypted that way. But what about when you get some of that data back and you want to persist it to isolated storage or some sort of local file at that point? If you're just serializing your objects out, then it's very easy for a person to go find that file and open it up, look at your XML or your serialized object, and boom, they have this data that you were trying so hard to protect with SSL back and forth. This is just an example of how you can basically have some simple extension methods to serialize, deserialize that data as you're persisting it. It's not everything, right? So you have the data in motion, you have this data at rest. Assuming that if your code can do this, a person who can get into your code can still potentially, you know, decrypt it. The problem
at a breakpoint to after I call the extension method.
Well, yeah, I guess the thing is, in the end, is that anytime the person has access to the key that's going to be used to decrypt it, which they do because they have your app, then there's a hole. But this makes it a lot harder, right? So now a person doesn't just have to have access to Notepad and Windows Explorer. They actually have to, you know, disassemble code and things like that. So it's sure. all steps. And he actually goes into that, he or she, I don't know this person.
Caleb.
Goes into the different levels of security and how you need to pay attention to each of these levels, and here's a piece for one of those levels. So
I like this.
Stuff.
I had done an extension method to serialize content, and actually I think it was, yeah, I did the where T equals I serialize. Well, I didn't never thought to do encryption, which yep. is like an easy one to do. Although maybe you may not want it for certain situations. Somebody wants to edit their file or
yeah,
whatever.
It depends. I guess the thing is, if it's supposed to be completely hidden to the user, and so a game, imagine. So the isolated storage files are something that, you know, the user, I guess, could find, but you certainly have no intent for them to find it.
Yeah, this
then
was...
Then encrypting is a great way to reduce the chance of people futzing.
This was a YouTube video downloader, so it'd yeah. be like, you know, your list and favorite categories.
So you don't care.
Which, yeah.
In fact, if someone wants to play with it, that's
edit
fine.
That, yeah, add more categories in a hand file, sure. Which brings us to IntelliTrace, one of my favorite features in Visual Studio. And the you know, idea behind it is basically capturing application state information while the application is actually working, and being able to walk through. And I think one of the coolest parts of IntelliTrace is one, the ability to actually have it work in, say, Azure mm-hmm. as well. And you have some experience around IntelliTrace as well.
So what's interesting is reading this article, it's talking about using IntelliTrace in production, and we already can do that in Azure, where essentially it's exactly what's being described here. You can tell your Azure instance that I want you to be capturing IntelliTrace debug information, downloading it all, and then right inside Visual Studio, I can like download those logs, and Visual Studio will parse and look at them as if, you know, you were doing IntelliTrace locally.
Playback, yeah.
So it's the same effect. Now this is basically on any, you know, web server that I've built in Visual Studio, I push out to just IIS local or you know, on a host, and I get that same functionality. So it doesn't say it in the article, and so I could be wrong. There could be a difference between how the Azure stuff works and this. Mm-hmm. But it looks to me that feature that we have in Azure brought to across the board to anyone who's deploying into production with an app built in Visual Studio 11. So it's cool beans.
Cool stuff. Which brings us, you know, a nice transition on the Azure side to map reduce patterns, algorithms, and use cases. And, you know, a lot of people are doing stuff with or considering Hadoop and big data. It's when they get into, you know, when you start having, you know, gigabytes and gigabytes on a daily basis, and then you need to crunch on multiple days, what do you do with big data where it isn't really designed to be relational? What are your thoughts on this stuff?
Well, I think the big thing with Hadoop and things like that, it's cool. We talk about MapReduce, people read about it, and they're like, that'd be great, I think. But what this helps with, there's an article, and the Ilya, actually there's two articles, but anyways, Ilya goes through scenarios. They're basically use cases almost. Here's an example of a type of problem where MapReduce is the solution. And I think that this
distributed search.
Well, I mean, there's that. There's log processing, that kind of thing. But he goes through, reporting. There's like five or six different categories, gives an example, and then shows what the sort of pseudocode algorithm is that you would use in MapReduce to solve it. Because I think a lot of people know it helps me with big data, but does it actually work for my problem? Is my problem, unless it's one of the obvious ones.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are like, why do I need Hadoop? Everything's fine.
But if your problem actually does or could be manipulated to fit one of these algorithms, then he gives you all the data you need to know what the individual processors are going to do, the iterators, the combinators, all the different things, and explains them in a really, it's really clear. And I think that's handy because some problems are more obvious that they would fit into this, and then there's others where, you know, like you said, if you could adjust it a little, if you could tilt the actual processing, it would fit into this, and then suddenly you could use the Hadoop libraries and things like that. So
cool. Our friend of the show, Phil Hack.
Is he still a friend of the show?
Of course he's still a friend of the show. How dare you? How dare you?
I'm just saying.
Phil Hack on the state of NuGet. So I think a lot of people are familiar with NuGet, and this is kind of where they are with the NuGet team, what stuff they're actually working on, what they're tracking in their issue tracker.
And kind of just a reminder that they're doing stuff. I think that's the start is his response to people saying, it's stale, it hasn't moved, and yet there's a whole bunch of things in progress, and he kind of details how you can follow along with what they're working on and what's coming up and things like that.
Now, the cool thing that we noticed was he was talking about Jabber.
Jabber, so you already know about this?
Jabber.
So Jabber appears to be kind of like a real-time chat IRC kind of site. It's kind of funky. It's jabr.net. Is that you go to the site, and this could be a criticism, but it's not meant to be, really. But there's no introduction. There's no what is this or how do I get it. There's just a chat window, and you can just start interacting with it right then and there. It's cool and hopefully scalable. This is the kind of stuff I wanted to read more about, and you don't really get the data there. But supports a lot of cool sort of IRC standard commands, does login through OpenID providers such as Twitter and Google and things like that. And they have a chat room there where the team talks about things.
Yeah, so when you want to have feedback into their design decisions for a bug,
you get right into their coffee chat kind of discussion.
You get right in there. Yep. So I love this. I love the transparency and stuff. So definitely cool stuff if you're a NuGet person.
Same kind of topic going here.
So this is setting up your NuGet library. So
this is building it. Yes. So this is not, obviously we know about the what do they call that one? The global one, the official one, the core
public
one. And that's
public
actually all I've ever attached to. But you can have your own. In a corporate case, obviously.
Classic idea is, why doesn't Microsoft just basically have a NuGet repo so everybody that's working on web projects? Yeah, okay. Well, I this weekend.
Okay. No, that'd be cool. And it is, I think sometimes we forget that it's meant to have, you can set up many repositories, because, I connect just to the one.
It'd be great, so it'd be like licenses that are friendly for us to use, other components that maybe
pre-vetted.
We don't even know about that other people do. So, hey, user component reporting thing.
There are things internally sort of like that, but they could do it with NuGet, and then we could use it from Visual Studio.
Yeah, there's, we've had some public discussions on things like Garage and CodeBox and some of the things that
so they
that
could,
we've had
if
before.
They went NuGet, then suddenly I get the whole search, download, and the package management, which in dependencies.
Oh, yeah, new version.
It's great.
Yeah, so love that. So, cool stuff. Again, this is kind of like our ongoing theme, but this is the Going Native Interactive panel, which is just kind of rock stars of C++, actually, So
it's pretty crazy, the set of people that were here for that event.
Yeah.
Speakers and attendees, but I don't know them.
I told you, I saw some folks from Bungie, and I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah,
oh,
that was awkward for you.
It's so warm. Oh, God. But definitely rockstar folks coming into this. And this is the
panel has the collection of them. We put a big frame picture of that up.
Yeah, yeah. So
once again, Charles isn't here, so I'm not allowed to talk about this too much. But I did watch the keynote, and it's awesome stuff.
Yeah, love Bjarne's keynote. Yep. So Now, our next thing is Microsoft Mouse Mischief. So, the idea behind this is you have one PC, you have wireless mice, make sure to have wireless mice, you have PowerPoint, and you have a bunch of USB hubs.
It would work with wired mice. It would just look really silly.
It would be terrible.
So, to get the picture going here, all the students in the classroom have their own mouse.
Imagine we have mice.
They have their own mouse. And the teacher sets up something in PowerPoint. They have actually a little, not an SDK, because it's a template. They have templates for setting up quizzes and other things you can interact with.
It's actually a PowerPoint add-in.
Yeah.
And it's free.
And then all the students can interact while the teacher is talking, which seems somewhat like a recipe for distraction. But yet it means they're doing something. So they're at least they're focused on what's on the screen and what they're supposed to be learning. So they're distracted from being bored.
Yes. Do I distract my kids or do I have them be bored?
We were confused. We were looking at it. We were trying to understand, do they all have PCs, which would be bad and
exorbitant,
crazy. But they don't. They all have mice. So then we're like, well, so what do the mice hook up to? But they all hook up to that central PC. So I guess, do they have to do anything to the PC other than the PowerPoint add-in? Do they have to install different drivers? I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, there's specific instructions that you can actually download and see, and example lessons as well. So definitely check out the site for more.
But they can go up to 25 mice, and they do it through USB hubs.
Yeah.
Chained USB hubs, up to 25 mice on Windows 7, and basically any mouse that's wireless and has a USB dongle, that's a lot of dongles.
Yeah. So
crazy stuff, but it's neat.
I think it'd be fun. I actually would love to do this for a conference and just have like 400 little. I think it'd be hilarious. Okay, if we did 20, that'd be like three times our viewership at this point. So, which brings us to Picks of the Week.
See, now the viewership's going to go spiking way up.
Yes.
If people could do that.
What are we talking about here?
Defrag. So this isn't just a suck up to Larry. As people may don't usually watch Channel 9 shows. I'll try to flip my laptop around in a minute. But anyways, Defrag is awesome because it always has a list of the links, time codes. I can jump through and watch little bits of it that are cool. And in the most recent episode, there's a bunch of cool stuff. There almost always is. But there's using your laptop as a Wi-Fi hotspot, which is neat. And then one that I turned around, and I always think this is the measure of whether or not something's really, really appealing to a developer. If the moment you see it, you go and do it right afterwards. And so he has setting your lock screen background.
Yes.
And so basically when your computer is locked.
When your computer is locked.
I'm going to just show you my laptop. It normally just has like the big blue Windows thing. Now,
when
my computer is locked... It's not other people's kids. It's all my child.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, it's good. I actually set it to this background, which is a collection of photos from my son and I's trip to Taiwan. But I actually might write some code that puts different things into this same location on like a timed basis, right? So then when I lock it, it's like, who knows what I'm going to see? I might see a dragon. Or I might see pictures of my kids.
Oh, that's kind of a fun idea, too.
I'll write it. Maybe I could... put it on coding for fun.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah,
maybe.
But anyway, so...
He's back after 5 years.
It's just
years.
An example of Defrag has cool stuff all the time. And in this one issue, there was the laptop thing. There was the background. And there was even changing the icon for a pinned site, which is kind of interesting because sometimes I pin sites that don't have a pinned icon. I pin them because I want to. I can set an icon.
Mm.
And that's neat. So then I don't just have a bunch of IE... things down there that I have to hover over, I can put icons.
There you go. All right, that brings us to my pick of the week, which is Herb Sutter's C++ 11 talk, which was the day 2 keynote. So if you haven't yet, you should definitely check it out. Herb's an awesome speaker. He actually has the 40-pound C++, thing that they actually shipped out and some of the people. And really, I think the key thing he talks about language evolution, how they're trying to change features, really talk about the different things they're trying to do. So the new scenarios, mm-hmm. from capturing platforms, from uniting the language, from cleaning up the language and some of the syntax. Like, can we go from before to after and really trying to make that really nice. Use of lambdas and so
and,
on.
And I think whenever we have all, we have a lot of C++ content of late, but all of it generates a ton of comments and discussion. And I always think that's another good measure of developer interest is that they're willing to fight over it. Some of the Going Native episodes, not from the event, but some of the Going Native episodes had like 200 comments. And it's just going on and on and on about, you know, sometimes an argument over syntax, best way to do something, people finding errors in the presenter's content. But people obviously are paying a lot of attention, and this keynote was one of the best things out there. So
cool. All right, well, thank you, Duncan, and thanks everyone at home.